Welcome to JVL, your place to learn from Japan's venture leaders about the promising startup ecosystem in the land of the rising sun. Hey there, I'm Kento, your host for JVL, and today I'm talking to Masato Nakamura. Masato is a partner at Partners Fund, a venture capital firm focused on investing in early-stage startups mostly in Japan. In his past, he has been taking on business roles at large companies such as Takeda and SoftBank, and lately he's been more focused on early-stage startups with Plug and Play and Partners Fund. Based on his experience working at the intersection of big corporates and startups, I'm very excited to talk to him on the topic of open innovation in Japan, which has been a buzzword in the Japanese business world for a while. I'm also curious to find out more about his path into the startup ecosystem and why he chose to become a full-time venture capital investor. Thanks for listening, and please enjoy my conversation with Masato. All right, Masato, then thanks a lot for joining the Japan's Venture Leaders session today. I'm very excited to talk to you. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you for inviting me onto your podcast.
Yeah, thanks a lot for coming again. So today's topic will be about open innovation. For me personally, it's not a word that I use often. So I kind of understand the one sentence, the definition of what it is. But I think you're a perfect person to talk to about this topic just because you have many years of experience working at the intersection between big corporates and startups. So I think I'm really looking forward to hearing your insights on that topic. But before we go into that direction, I also would like to spend some time understanding your background of how you found your way into the startup ecosystem. The way I understand it is you're currently a partner at the Partners Fund VC firm. So you're obviously like neck deep in the startup ecosystem in Japan. But first, I would just like to understand like how you found your way into the startup ecosystem in Japan.
Okay, let me first start with the introduction of Partners Fund. It's often confused with Partners Global, which is a huge fund, a global fund. It's not the huge fund, it is a very small fund. Seed stage focused VC here in Tokyo. We are a two-man team. We originally set up our first fund back in 2018 under a different name called Full Commit Partners. We rebranded and set up our second fund only just 2 months ago in September of 2022. And we are currently actively investing in C-stage startups located mostly in Tokyo. We can invest globally as well, but our focuses are on consumer technology and DX and legacy industry startups. So that is what we invest in. And I am, because we are a two-man team, we do everything. I'm a partner. My partner is the other guy called Yamada is the GP. We do everything from sourcing to investing to helping with the startups. So, you know, that's what we do. Now, how I ended up here is to briefly talk about my journey through the kind of large corporates to the VC startup ecosystem. I've started first with a pharmaceutical company here in Tokyo, a Japanese pharmaceutical company. And I was actually part of HR team working on restructuring of that company. And as part of that restructuring, I mean, we were basically, to be blunt, laying off people, but just laying off people kind of destroys the culture of the company. So we decided to create a motivating program for the employees, and that was to do a spin-off startups to carve out companies from the large corporations. And I was involved in the HR kind of HR policy management of that program, and that's how I became interested in those startups. And just to add on the detail of that program, we span out 9 companies and 3 companies have exited. So that it was a really successful program. And that's really how I got into the startup ecosystem. After that, I went into SoftBank Group, where I was working as in the finance team, working on the IPO, one of the largest IPOs to date in the Tokyo Stock Exchange. And I was also issuing bonds, and they were all basically to fund the SoftBank Vision Fund activities back in those days. So what I really wanted to do in SoftBank Group was to kind of fuel the rise of startups that was happening back in 2017-18 in the Japanese ecosystem. And the reason I went to SoftBank Group. And then I did my MBA, and after that I joined Plug and Play, the Silicon Valley based accelerator. I went I went to Osaka to set up a branch office of the Plug and Play, and that's where I spent the next 2 years working with large corporates such as traditional Japanese construction companies based in Osaka area, AC manufacturer based in Osaka, and I was helping them work with startups and start and kind of do their to promote the open innovation in their companies. And after that, I joined this kind of the current company. So basically, the reason I joined VC and moved from Plug and Play was basically that I wanted to work more directly with startups instead of working with large corporates. And so that's going to tell you something about why the story I'm going to tell you about open innovation. But that's my story.
Thanks a lot for sharing. And so if I understand it correctly, it was kind of a coincidence that you happened to spin out startups at the first pharmaceutical company you worked at. And so if that wouldn't have happened, then maybe you wouldn't have found yourself in startups now.
Definitely true. I didn't know what startups were back in those days. I didn't know what VCs were back in those days. So purely coincidence, definitely.
Oh, that's crazy. And could you tell me maybe a little bit more about what incentivized you to want to work more with startups instead of spending your time with corporates?
I'm going to talk about this a bit later as well, but the large corporations, at the end of the day, a good, say, cooperation, partnership between large corporations and startups is fueled by the drive and the speed of the startups. And it's rarely the other way around where the large corporations are taking initiative. And I realized that from that perspective, if I wanted to kind of drive the innovation within Japan overall, it's definitely better to work with Japanese startups, and not just with Japanese startups, but with startups overall, working with large corporates here in Japan. So that's why I decided to help and support the startup ecosystem more directly.
And how big of a decision was it for you to decide, after Plug and Play, A, go into VC, B, start your own company, or maybe C, join an already existing startup? Why VC?
So the Partners Fund was an interesting choice for me, in that it was, in a way, an entrepreneurial challenge, as well as just going into a VC, because we're a two-man team and it's our second fund. Right now, what I'm worried about is not just about doing good investments and making returns and working with successful startups. It's also for me about performing well enough that we can create our third fund, fourth fund, fifth fund, and creating a larger team for the organization. So for me, this is like working both at a startup and at a VC.
That makes sense. One thing I was also wondering about just now is, before you joined your current position as a VC at your company, you must have had some image of what it's like to be a VC, right? Just by interacting with startups and maybe hearing some stories, or also through the corporates. So how did that initial image of what VCs are differ from what it's actually like right now to work there?
Well, I did have a chance to do a lot of internships before I joined Partners Fund. So I once worked with Shell Ventures during my MBA. And I also actually did my first internship with Full Commit Partners, the first fund of our fund. So I knew the gist of what the VC work entailed. That being said, I guess one thing that still surprised me after really becoming a venture capitalist is, and I guess the hardest thing about working as a VC is saying that you're not able to invest in a startup. We do 30, 40 meetings with entrepreneurs, and out of those 30, 40 meetings, we get one investment decision. And I think that's the kind of the average percentage for globally for how VCs make decisions. And so that's 95% of the time we're actually saying no. Knowing full well that the entrepreneurs, they put their lives and their passion to that work. And while it's such a privilege to be able to be part of their journey once we make the investment decision, but just because of that, it's always hard to find the right words to say that you're not able to invest. And sometimes it's because of our funding fund policy or whatever. And there are so many myriad reasons. And I always find that the hardest part of the job and the most crucial part of the job, I think.
Yeah, I guess it's a very emotional thing if you kind of hear the story and the background of the founders. And as you said, they put their lives to that, and not being able to support them is, I guess, I can't really speak from experience, but it must be something not that nice. And I was also wondering, so is that something that you wish you would have known before joining as a VC now? Or is there anything other than that, that you kind of wish you would have known about the job as a full-time VC now that you're doing it?
Well, I guess a simple answer is that I wish I had known was that it's such an exhilarating and wonderful job to have. Because if I had known, I would have become a venture capitalist a lot earlier in my career. So, yeah.
Are there things that speak against you doing it earlier than you're currently doing it now?
I think there are so many ways to become a good venture capitalist. And there are a lot of venture capitalists out there. So I think everyone needs to find his or her own niche. And I think it's the journey to that venture capitalist job that allows you to have that niche. So I think becoming a venture capitalist maybe in your 50s might actually be the best choice for some capitalists. So yeah, I think that's the case against.
Okay, makes sense. And would you, now that you're like really enjoying the journey as a VC, is there any scenario where you could consider also not founding another VC fund, but actually founding a separate business as a startup? Or is that kind of out of option?
Potentially 30, 40 years from now, once the fund is successful. But at the moment, no.
Is that like the typical commitment that people like put into their heads when they start a VC fund, like 30 or 40 years? Is that like the average? Or
if you're in a partner position, and then you really are committing to that, usually the 10-year span of the fund. But for me, especially as I'm actually the Yamada, my partner in the fund is actually a high school friend. So because taking that into account as well, it's not like I can just leave after 10 years. So yeah, I want to see it through until the fund is truly successful.
You said you also like sometimes consider international investments. Is that mostly inbound, or like how actively do you seek US or like international opportunities, given that you're based in Japan?
To give you some background and to clarify, we are a small fund, and our second fund is around $8 million in fund size. Of course, it's in Japanese yen, so it's 1 billion Japanese yen. And given that size, the amount that we can invest abroad is very small. So are we actively investing? Well, not really. We are kind of being picky and choosy. We're not in that position, but we want to invest in startups that we can actually understand. And as to the question whether it's inbound or outbound, so we're looking to invest in startups that are actually based abroad. And we want to actually invest with local VCs. So it's really hard for Japanese VCs to take lead positions simply because we cannot oversee their activities. And so we want to partner with local VCs to invest in international startups.
And so I'm imagining that you're spending most of your time like talking to founders in Japan. And out of these conversations, what is one thing that most founders in Japan struggle with in their business lives?
God, I think that's a great question. And at the same time, it really depends on the business. There are some generic answers that could be given, like, you know, finding good engineers, which is always hard in Japan. Or finding attractive international talent, which is again also very hard to find in Japan simply because the numbers aren't there, or simply because, you know, the funding size here in Japan isn't large enough to attract the top talents internationally. You have things like that, but I guess something more kind of Japan specific is, I think it depends on the business you're doing, but let's say if you're doing a B2B business, it's about really building a good sales network, which is really important in Japan. Of course, back the SaaS trend with a lot of venture capitalists talking about the PLG, the product-led growth, that is a philosophy that's a process or an approach that doesn't usually work well in Japan, simply because it's the business ecosystem here in Japan is a lot different from what you have in the States. The IT literacy of the average man working in a really traditional legacy industry here in Japan, that doesn't allow you to have that PLG growth. They need to have the system explain. And that's why we have all these SIers, system integrators, who are dominant in the Japanese market, right? So B2B growth relies a lot on the sales and building the right network of local businesses to work with to kind of, you know, introduce you to new clients. I think that is something that a lot of Japanese businesses and startups struggle with.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think there was also a thing that I recently thought about, is the fact that oftentimes, like, you try to compare KPIs in Japan with how things work abroad. And to your point, like, specifically on the B2B, maybe SaaS example, not only is it hard to make something possible, such as the product-led growth strategy, but just in general, the sales cycles and like how long winding the process is of convincing a business to try out a new solution offered by a startup, like that alone is something that is must be very demotivating from a founder's perspective in the B2B space, right?
Well, it depends. I wouldn't go that far in that you can't find your initial niche. So there are, of course, a lot of IT companies with high literacy in the newest SaaS, for example. And so you can target those companies, but it doesn't give you the scale that you need at the end of the day. So in the long run, you need that network, right? And so I think that's where the challenge is. I wouldn't say that it's demotivating, because at first, as long as you find the right initial niche, I think you can get growth. But it's the long run that becomes a long slog and can be a bit difficult for some founders.
Does it also mean that you kind of have like a little bit different benchmarks of how quickly growth is supposed to happen, for example, in the B2B example compared to other markets, that, I don't know, in Japan, you might as a VC expect growth to not happen as quickly, considering that sales just take maybe a little bit longer here?
Well, benchmarks are benchmarks, so we still use it a lot. I think the US example is something that we still aim for, right? And I think it's not something that we should simply change, because if you change that, you need to change the valuation. You need to change the whole kind of the equation of investment. So we still have that in place, but then the how you get there becomes a different question altogether, I think, depending on the market.
All right, cool. Then thanks a lot for your takes on these a little bit also random questions. But now moving on to the actual topic of open innovation and as it relates to how things work here in Japan. So as I mentioned in the beginning, you already like had experience in corporates as well as interacting with startups and now being at a VC yourself. So you had probably a lot of interaction with the topic of open innovation. Before we go into the discussion, I would just like for you to first explain in your words, like, how would you define open innovation?
Open innovation, the most elusive word out there, I think, a phrase out there currently.
Right after the X, or?
Yeah. Yes, truly, truly. I mean, because no innovation is truly closed in that sense. I think everything is open. But in our context, for our discussion, I think whenever a company relies on not only on internal resources, so not only, say, on their R&D staff, but also on multiple external sources to drive innovation. And that could be patents, public patents, that could be using external agencies, or simply like customer feedback, relying heavily on customer feedback to drive their innovation. And that, I would say, is open innovation.
I'm not sure if, I mean, that's maybe just my bias, but I think the word open innovation was not something I heard a lot, for example, in Europe, even though I had some experience with startups. But coming to Japan, I feel like the word is used like a little bit more often. So why do you think Japan or companies here care a lot about open innovation? And maybe it's more also the big corporates, but what's your take on that?
So this is, again, going to be my take and my opinion. So I'm not really sure about the accuracy of it. So from my perspective, I see it as this the one characteristic of the Japanese market. And say, if you take the top market cap companies in Japan over the last few decades, I mean, they haven't changed much in Japan, whereas it has changed drastically in other countries, especially the United States. And so in Japan, the big old companies very much remain the drivers of growth and innovation. But because they're old, they are much more reliant on, they need to have external, what should I say? They have need to have external sources of innovation to drive their own innovation, right? I mean, in the States, I think the drivers of innovations are actually VC-backed companies. So they don't need to have actually open innovation. What they are doing is that they are attracting the best talents, the top talents in the United States, because they simply have the money from the VC funding. And that is what is driving a lot of the R&D activity. I think there is some statistics that says that almost half of the R&D conducted in the United States is conducted by VC-backed companies in the United States over the last decade. So that tells you how much innovation is being driven by newer companies. Again, so that is drastically different from Japan, where the top talents remain in the old companies. And so I think that is the dynamics of old large companies still remaining the engines of the Japanese economy, but then needing a source of new growth leads to this desperate and search for innovation. And that is why open innovation is such a hot word here in Japan.
And I'm not sure like to which detail you're allowed to share about this, but could you maybe talk from your experience working maybe at Plug and Play or other companies where you've seen firsthand how these open innovation projects like work?
I think the successful cases are where there is a really detailed, concrete idea of the strategic fit between the large corporates and the startups. So one case I have seen is a company that I know and I worked with was a food tech company I had the privilege of working with, and it entered into a partnership with this old food-related manufacturers. And the startup was able to provide the kind of the product development and effective marketing expertise that they had, whereas the large corporate provided them the much-needed expertise in driving down production cost. And so I think without... Really, the beauty of the partnership was that without the expertise and manufacturing assets of the large corporates, I don't think the startup would have been sustainable in their business. They had good product, they had a beautiful marketing team, but simply the production cost was driving them into a bad position. And the partnership really saved them in that sense. And on the other hand, the large corporate was able to gain this driver of growth, new products from that partnership. And potentially, who knows, it might go into an M&A exit in the future. So I can't really tell you which companies they are. But that is one successful case of open innovation that I saw. And so if I could give a bit more detail into the details of it, I think the successful open innovation cases often start with the commitment of the executives at large corporates. The success of that I was talking about was, I think, really driven by the fact that it was based on this understanding that the partnership might lead to something larger, like an M&A, right? And because of that, the executives were involved from the first place. And so there was commitment from large corporates to go through with the partnership and actually bring something out of it. So I think that's one good case of open innovation that I've seen. Yeah.
So basically, like if the startup and in your example, the food tech startup collaborating with the food production company, the corporate, like they would together develop one product and then the revenue would be shared, or like how did that work?
So it wasn't a revenue share. So it was actually made, the return was actually from the corporate side was through an investment. Right. So they actually bought some shares. So it wasn't a full M&A. It was simply a partnership in that sense. That happens. I think that is a much better option. I mean, it has its risks. I mean, if you go into a bad relationship, it's harder to get out of But I think that drives the, again, the commitment of the executives on the large corporates. I think that is a good form of partnership. There are other partnerships where, you know, because open innovation is such a good, hot word right now, a lot of large corporates have like open innovation teams that are going to approach startups to work on these potential partnerships. And in many cases, they don't work simply because there isn't that commitment. I'm not saying that they don't always work. So I'm not going to say that you shouldn't talk to large corporates. You should, because if it's the right fit, it can be a good driver of growth. But when there are cases, what I'm saying, I guess, is that there are a lot of cases where the expectations of the large corporates, the KPIs that they have, aren't clear, simply because they're simply kind of focusing on this elusive thing called open innovation. And in those cases, I think the strategic fit of the partnership can be hard to find.
Yeah. And it also seems like it's kind of a nice marketing thing to do as a big company. If you can say that you're pursuing open innovation, they might not 100% know what the actual outcomes of that might be, but just using the word in your investor calls or like talking to other shareholders might be a cool thing to do. So that already might be an interesting return, but obviously the ideal case is that you also can create some actual financial impact through these collaborations. So in general, like it's the commitment, like making sure that both parties are committed in that partnership and no one drops the ball. That's kind of the success factor. And it's probably also like important to like cement the commitment by some financial, connection, either by the big company making some investment, like equity investment into the smaller startup.
Right. So yeah, that is, I think you summarized it pretty well. I'm not suggesting that you should always have, the large corporate invest in you, but I'm just saying it might be one good way of drawing that commitment. Yes.
How do you see the future of open innovation? Do you see the world where startups in Japan will keep being maybe a small impact relative to the whole in terms of how innovative Japan can be? Or will it kind of try to be more similar to the US, where more and more new innovations and growth will come from smaller companies and not from corporates?
In the long run, I think we need to have the startups make big impact. Otherwise, I don't see the Japanese economy going well without that change. In the short run, of course, there are a lot of entrepreneurs who are doing their best to change that. There are still a lot of political policy hurdles that make it hard for startups to find good talent, for example. I mean, the labor liquidity here in Japan is very low, so people don't change jobs, top talents stay with the large corporates, that sort of thing. I mean, there are hurdles, but I'm hoping that the things will change, and we're trying to change that as well.
Okay. Nice. Sounds really good. Then that's it to wrap up the topic on open innovation. And to wrap up the entire podcast, I just have three more questions I would like to get your take on. Rapid fire questions, so no long answers needed. The first question would be, and they're like also a little bit more random, so not really like connected to the topic of open innovation. But the first would be, what is the favorite place for you in Japan?
Kamakura.
Why? Oh, sorry. I shouldn't ask why. Sorry. But moving on to the next question. What makes you happy?
When I am bouldering. I do bouldering. Yeah. I love bouldering. Yeah.
Nice. I've also noticed that it's kind of a trend in Europe or in Berlin. I oftentimes see a lot of people who boulder, but that trend might have also came to Japan. So that's a interesting trend, I guess. And the third question, what does Japan need to blossom?
What does Japan need to blossom? A labor market that allows everyone to move freely and to move into startups.
Cool. All right. Perfect answer for the startup ecosystem. So Masato, I really enjoyed the conversation. I learned more about open innovation. As you said, I think it's a very abstract concept that a lot of people like to talk about, but it helps to hear from someone like you what it actually looks like on the ground. So thanks a lot for taking the time, and see you next time.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for listening to this episode with Masato. I find Masato's journey into the startup ecosystem interesting because it seems to have been purely coincidental how it happened. I think that that is the beauty of randomness, and it also shows that the right first exposure can trigger many more to get excited about startups, which are so much needed. My takeaway on the topic of open innovation is the importance of incentives to align corporates with startups, and that financial investments into startups can be a powerful tool to keep both parties committed to the partnership. To learn more about Masato's company, make sure to visit fullcommit-partners.com. If you like this episode, please follow and rate it on whichever podcast platform you're listening from. And for feedback, please reach out to jvl.podcast@gmail.com. Thanks again, and see you next time.